The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Banks. We are the first and number one global fintech radio show. And I'm in New York City. We're in the offices of American Bank today, and Mark Hochstein's going to be with us shortly, and Penny Crosman's here. Say hi, Penny.
Hi, thanks for coming over.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us here. It's great that American Bank is letting us use their studio today. So, and we are starting to warm up a little bit. Thaw in New York City. There's still a little bit of snow around some places, but most of it's gone from that big storm that we had a couple of weeks ago. Just first of all, some conference announcement, conference announcements. I'm going to have trouble speaking today, I can tell. Innovate Finance is coming up in London, the Global Summit on April 10th and 11th. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be helping with the demo day for the Pitch 360 competition at Guildhall. I told you, right? Finovate Spring is coming up 2017, April 26th, 27th at San Jose Convention Center in lovely San Jose. And I don't know, what's the thing about Dionne Warwick jokes? I don't get Dionne Warwick jokes. I don't get that, Rachel, anyway.
Oh, do you know the way to San Jose?
Oh, it's a do hit song. You know the, yeah, okay, yeah, I get it. Okay, all right. Thanks, Penny. See, this is why you're on the show.
Finally, it becomes clear.
So you can register for that using the code BREAKINGBANKS20 and you get a 20% discount. Of course, all of these conference announcements you'll find on our conference page. BAI is having their Innovation Global Awards again. Don't forget to get your applications in if you're a fintech startup or you're doing some sexy innovation stuff. And applications are due by the April the 28th, so get them in right away. And Findeavor is prepping for their London conference, June 12th and 13th. Don't forget to get tickets for that. BBanksDevR20 is the discount code there. And, drumroll, we are pleased to announce that we will be the official podcast partner for Money 2020 in both Las Vegas and Europe. And Fintech 5 podcast and Breaking Banks will be there. So, woo-hoo! That's a bit of a coup, isn't it? So, first American banker and then Money 2020. So.
At least we were first.
You were, absolutely.
That's all we care about.
Yeah, a long time. So, in the news, we had, of course, the Brexit was triggered yesterday in Britain. So that's the fun and games have started there. Theresa May sent her letter. What did you?
Is that going to affect you now that Moving has an office and an app in the UK?
Not necessarily. I don't think it's going to be a big effect for us. I think we are doing some business there, and it could be an issue longer term for fintechs who have a European presence. Just purely because of the passporting issues and things like that. But not such an issue for us. I think more I'd be worried about maybe if you're a number 26 or Tandem or whatever, then that's going to be potentially an issue. So, but WeChat, it hasn't stopped them from opening an office in London and focusing on Europe. Did you see that news?
Yeah, I mean, their growth is incredible. They have a 897 million users. Yeah. I was just looking at PayPal for comparison. It's got 197 million users.
Right.
So, I mean, they're just seem unstoppable.
Well, between them and Alipay,
yes,
these guys are just, I mean, so, you know, you saw the news on Alipay, right? They've invested in Paytm in India, Kakao in Korea, Globe, GCash in Philippines. They bought MoneyGram here in the US. These Chinese payments networks are just going, they are setting the scene to be the dominant payment rails on mobile over the next decade or so.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time before US players start feeling feeling threatened.
Well, if you look at like PayPal was the biggest payments network globally. Right. Like they took that position from Visa a while back, but now, I mean, both Tencent, you know, WeChat and Alipay both dwarf PayPal. Visa and MasterCard aren't even close right now.
Right, it's amazing. Do you think U.S. regulators would let them into the U.S.?
Well, I think that's why Alipay bought MoneyGram. I think it was the only way they could get in.
It's the foot in the door.
Yeah, so it'll be very, very interesting. So we did see that the SEC rejected the Bitcoin ETF on the stock exchange, if you're watching that one. Not a huge surprise, considering this was SolidX's Bitcoin ETF. Not a surprise, considering the decision earlier in the month on the Winklevoss ETF as well. But in other news, MasterCard has acquired New Data Security. Did you see our news, Penny, about moving?
Yeah, good for you. So TD Bank, now I'm going to be a MySpend customer.
Eventually. There you go.
So when is that going to actually
in
go
terms
live?
Of the US?
Yeah.
We're still not sure the exact go live date for those guys here in the US, but we are working on it. We're looking at the new release of savings in Canada as well now. So, you know, we're live. We've been live for a little while with savings here in the US. So, and that's going well. So we hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll launch that in Canada first. But there's going to be a launch in Indonesia, hopefully middle of the year as well. So you're going to be hearing a lot more news about what
global.
We're doing.
So yeah. Is the strategy one bank per country and spread across the world?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, there may be some flexibility to that, but at the moment, you know, we pick one partner per country. It's just, it takes a fair bit of time. You know, as a startup, it takes a bit of effort to commit to a new bank and getting them up to speed. So we find it easier just to pick
a
winner.
And they don't want to have other competitors with the exact same thing or something. So it definitely makes sense. And then will you keep moving standalone as well?
Yeah, so far. Okay. I mean, you should hear some news hopefully on that front that could be significant as well. Okay. Lots of potentially stuff coming up, which is quite interesting. But so winners and losers. We should do that. We should look at who we thought won this week. And this is interesting. EMV switch. Did you see this? US e-commerce fraud is up.
Oh, okay.
Not down.
Well, that's what everyone's been predicting for quite a while.
Do you think that's because we went with chip and signature instead of chip and PIN?
That's kind of a logical thing, because I think the signature provides no security whatsoever. So, I think chip and PIN was kind of a politically not accepted here. I think it was considered too hard for some of the banks to implement.
Yeah.
So Visa didn't try to force it on people. But nobody's looking at that signature. I mean, I just scroll something on, you know, when I need to sign.
Yeah.
You know, you see people just doing a slash, you know.
You know Dave Birch?
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, he signs anything but Dave Birch when he signs his name. So he knows that if someone pays using his card and signs Dave Birch, he knows it's fraudulent. Because he never uses his name.
That's a clever technique.
Yeah. Hopefully we can... we should get Dave back on the show soon. Mm. Yeah. We talked about it, right?
He's a really interesting guy.
He's a funny guy. So, Dave, if you're listening, shout out, hello from American Banker all the way in New York City. All right. So we should get into things here. So we have... joining us this week as our first guest is someone who's been on the show before. It's Derek Corcoran from Avoka. Derek, welcome back.
Thanks, Brett. It's been a while.
It has. Not that long, but the things keep going along, don't they? So now you guys had a really interesting report on the state of digital sales in banking that came out. So we wanted to get some insights because some new research has come out on how banks are adapting to sort of the demands of digital, particularly, I guess, on the revenue side. And you looked at North American banks, European and Australian banks in this report. So give us the high level in terms of sort of prospecting, acquisition and delivering, sales and service across digital. Where are we at with it?
Sure. So we had a researcher basically look at 32 banks and try to apply online and apply on mobile for the various products that they offered through their website. So we looked across personal banking, consumer banking, as well as business and wealth products. So, you know, for her sins, she looked at 2,423 separate banking products across those banks. So we're averaging 76 products per bank. Across those kind of three categories of business, consumer, and wealth. And look, there were a number of findings. The highest ones for me in terms of outcomes from the report were 77% of US adults, for example, own a smartphone, but only 28% of banking products have a mobile-friendly application experience.
Right.
So customers have embraced mobile rapidly, and the banks have realistically, they've been slow to respond.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, you know, Derek, when I'm at events, they always ask me one question. It's at every event, two questions I get at every event when I'm speaking. One is, what are the regulators going to do about this? Right? We hope regulators are going to stop these darn fintechs, you know. But the second one is, if you were a CEO of a bank today, what would you do? And, you know, my answer is really simple, is make sure you could deliver every product in your wheelhouse in real time on a mobile without a signature.
Even a mortgage or something really complicated?
Look at Countrywide used to do. They were the biggest mortgage seller in the United States prior to the financial crisis. And, you know, I'm sure they had some brokerage connections and like that, but it was all digital. So it's not that you can't do a mortgage. Now, people can still choose to go into a branch to get a mortgage, Penny, but it's a case of, if you don't want to do that, why should you be forced to go into a branch for any product today?
And that's another really interesting finding from the report. We looked at the ability to cross over between channels as part of the sales process or the application process. And our friends at PwC came out with a report that said, look, 88% of US consumers use multiple channels for a retail purchase, you know, buying a pair of sneakers or some jeans or a new headset or something like that. But only 22% of the banks offer customers the ability to cross over between channels when applying for a product. So if you want to start digital self-service for your mortgage, you know, you walk past, you see a house, you go, oh, I wonder if I could actually afford to purchase that place. You begin the application process, but then you want to come into a bank and talk to a banker, make sure you're doing the right thing. You have to start all over again. There's no kind of crossover for around 80% of products. There's no ability to cross over. And one of the other areas that we... it just stuns me, is if you're a small business and you need a banking product like a loan or even a deposit account, you better get ready to get in your car and drive to the nearest branch, because less than a quarter of small business banking products can be applied for online and less than 9% have a mobile-friendly experience. So the busiest people in the economy, the small business owners, are being forced to come into a branch if they want to get a banking product. And there's absolutely no reason for that. The integrations, the services, and so on to be able to do identity verification on individuals as well as on institutions, organizations, is there. But it hasn't been a focus.
So I think if you were to ask that, if you were to do the same survey in China for small businesses, you'd find most of the small businesses, particularly those working on Alibaba's platform, could do most of what they can't do in the UK, or the US as a small business, they could do online in China.
And there's the penalty of legacy, in that, you know, the organizations that we're looking at, the majority of them have been around for 50 to 150 years. So there's such a huge legacy investment in branches and in infrastructure and so on, that as they move towards digital, they're carrying that baggage forward. And so they're really struggling to kind of innovate, whereas you get the allies of the world who come in and say, well, we're building from scratch, so we build a digital-first experience.
So at this point, we are welcoming into the studio Mark Hochstein, who's joined us. Mark, welcome back.
Great to be here, Brett.
Yeah. So you guys can jump in with some questions, by the way.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess when I have spoken to bankers about this in the past, I think what happens is, there's a will to have really nice apps for small business people, but it's very hard to get the budget for it, because the thinking is they could just use a personal app. It's not worth the time and effort to create a whole separate app just for their needs, because the revenue and the volume just won't be worth it. Or that's the perception. I think for a lot of banks, just hiring enough developers for their basic mobile app for their consumers is a challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, let alone have something a decent website for their small business and corporate customers. Do you have any kind of sense of like how they could break through that? And you know, what is, you know, is there a strong business case for, you know, a really sophisticated small app specifically for small business people that that people ought to be considering?
Well, our focus, Penny, was very much on the revenue generation, the kind of sales process, the application process, as opposed to the app to subsequently manage the accounts. And if I was in a bank, I'd be selfish in the sense that even if my account management experience, my kind of PFM experience, if it's not a Movin style quality of experience for small business, I should be doing everything I possibly can to acquire small business customers, because they tend to be quite a profitable segment. They tend to be very loyal in comparison to consumers. They're less likely to move their business because they tend to have a bank that does everything for them, as opposed to a lot of consumers will spread their banking relationships across multiple different providers. You know, they'll go to one for the credit card that gives them the best miles. They'll go to somebody else for a mortgage to get the best rate. Hence, people like Mint have been creating a successful business doing that kind of aggregation, because consumers do distribute, whereas small businesses don't. So I believe there's a massive opportunity for somebody in the banking sector to say, we're going to look after small businesses. And that doesn't necessarily mean a relationship manager in a branch. You know, it's that combined with, if you want to do things in your own time, you know, when you've shut down your business for the day, when you've closed your cafe, or you're not doing electrician appointments or whatever it is you do, if you need to do banking, we're going to be open 24/7, because what you need to do with us is available digitally. So if you need a line of credit, it's very easy for you to get that without actually coming into a branch. So yeah, if I was the kind of CEO in a branch, I'd be prioritizing, how do I get those customers out of the market? And to your point about budget, because the banks have traditionally built these kinds of account opening and loan origination experiences themselves, they have struggled to get the budget, because the volume of transactions in small business is so much lower than it is in the consumer space. They haven't been able to justify the cost, which is where like Avoka has been able to generate a business, because we're providing them with a platform to accelerate that. It means it's lower budget, like lower investment, to actually digitize those experiences and go, you know, make it easier for that segment of the market. And guess what? They're going to reward you with their business.
So you looked at three markets: Northern America, Europe, Australia. Did any of those markets stand out as sort of a clear winner where they're getting it right?
Australia.
And why?
So,
no worries.
G'day. Yeah, I've got the polluted accent, so a bit like yourself, Fred. Originally from Ireland, but I spent 18 years in Australia, so my accent's just confused now, and I've been in Colorado for 2 years. So
I was a fellow Aussie last night over dinner, and we both agreed that Australia is a really nice place to go to for a holiday, but we're not sure we'd move back there because there's just so many Australians living there.
Look, what we found at Australia is, and this has been consistent.
Australian listenership.
They're all gone. So what we found is Australia is generally being a fast adopter of technology. So, you know, in terms of their penetration of cell phones, smartphones and so on, it eclipsed the US very early on. But what we also find is that the regulation in Australia protected the large banks from the financial crisis. So they didn't feel the hit that the rest of the world did. So they actually had a bigger war chest to actually invest in digital. And then they had a trailblazer in the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, kind of about 8 years ago. And they set such... they set such a high bar that the rest of the banks had to invest very, very quickly.
Isn't it interesting that one guy who had, you know, really strong leadership, he was the CIO at the time at CommBank. He's now at Barclays, I think, or he was at Barclays. But because he was such a strong personality and he had the support of the board and the senior exec, he was able to really move the needle. And because Australia is a small market, the four banks had to follow closely. I mean, the other three, what are they calling them? The four majors or whatever, followed
closely. Pillars.
Yep. Yeah. And suddenly, you know, you've had the market has moved significantly faster than other developed economies.
I just want to give a call out to one other person within CBA at the time. Did you ever get a chance to meet Andy Lark?
Well, Andy co-wrote my last book with me, dude.
Ah, I didn't know that. So yeah, Andy
contributed to Augmented, and he's now at zero.
He's at zero. He was a huge driving force the digitization and the customer-centric focus of CBA. And I'll give you a specific example. Andy had his team monitor people accessing Combank's digital properties, so their website, their mobile app, and their online banking, and he overlaid...
Social media, yeah.
Yeah, he overlaid that against a TV show. One of the most popular TV shows in Australia at the time. And he was able to show that there was a spike in activity every time there was an ad break during the TV show. So he went back to his team and said, give me an account opening experience that can be completed in 90 seconds. Because we have the length of an ad break to get a customer out of the market. So if they see an ad for us, I want to be able to get them out of the market before the TV show starts again and we lose their attention. So yeah, that's the kind of leadership that people like that. And he came from Dell, as you'd well know. So banking background. So very, very disruptive.
Yeah, I'm not just saying that because he helped me on Augmented. really intuitive. Both of those guys just really did change the landscape. So it's Australia owes its digital leadership to some extent to those guys. But Mark, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Derek, I mean, you mentioned that regulation in Australia had played an important part in terms of just preserving financial stability in that country, which set them up well to be innovative after the global financial crisis. What do you think is setting back the U.S.? Is it regulation? Is it just the culture of these institutions? Why do you see the U.S. being behind countries like Australia?
Look, the one thing that I just kind of qualify before I answer that is we did see some significant investment and some significant improvement because this is the second year we've generated this report. So we were able to benchmark against last year's data and we saw double-digit improvement in 9 of the 32 banks in terms of the volume of applications that could actually be applied for, the percentage of applications that could be applied for online. And the most significant change that we saw was actually in the US market. So some of the large banks here have been really doubling down on making it easier for people to apply for products through the digital channel. But that said, when I look at, just to give you an example, when we look at someone like Westpac in Australia, they have about 1,000 branches. Chase has 5,000. When we look at merchant terminals for a large bank in Australia, hence the kind of EMV discussion that we had earlier on, the large banks carry a fleet of about 35,000 merchant terminals. In the U.S., it's more like 350,000. So the scale for the large banks in the U.S. means that any change is a much bigger task. It's a much bigger area. And they're trying to divide up their time and their attention and their investment across so many different areas. You know, Apple's coming at them with Apple Pay, Google with their wallet, Ali is coming, trying to get into the market. So they're trying to defend on a number of different fronts. And regulations are changing. Like somebody told me there's something like 2 different regulations that hit the banking sector every single day that they're trying to react to that are consuming a significant amount of the budget and the time that the bank has to invest. But again, you know, selfishly, if I was a CEO in a bank, I'd be saying, well, hang on a second, everything else that I'm doing, regulation I need to be compliant with, otherwise I'm going to go out of business. But of all the things that I could be investing in, I need to be focusing on customer acquisition. I need to be getting customers out of the market because I can't earn the same revenue per customer that I used to. Fees are under massive pressure and interest rates are about as low as they've ever been. So in order to maintain the kind of shareholder returns that I need to achieve as a bank CEO, I need more customers. I need to actually, you know, achieve the same results by doubling the number of customers that I'm servicing. So I think that whole focus on how do I get customers out of the market needs to be a really huge thing that that gets attention.
Yeah.
Has your research shown that a strong correlation between having a great app and offering a lot of products and a lot of mobile enrollment in products and, you know, bringing in new customers and actual products?
Great question.
So if you build it, they will come?
Yeah. So if we look at the U.S., we're protecting the names of the innocent, I guess, within the report. But I can tell you that the two leaders within the U.S. market are Capital One and KeyBank. And KeyBank were a leader in last year's report as well. They do an incredibly good job of acquiring customers. And if you look at the 2015 annual report that KeyBank published, there's a stat in there that says that they grew their retail bank business at 4 times the industry average. So they do the best job of making it easy for people to apply for the entire range of products they have in the market, to your point, Brett, through the digital channel. It's a mobile-friendly experience. It's mobile responsive. I can save. I can come back to it. They've made it really easy. They've doubled down on that. And the market has, the consumers have rewarded them with their business. So they grew at 4 times the industry average. So yes, there is a correlation between growth and that kind of digital investment.
And do they have the best app, or is it is there something else that they're
Niven
doing?
Has the best app.
Well, right.
in terms of the kind of mobile app experience and PFM and so on, that really wasn't a focus for us. It was like acquisition experience, and the best in the US at the moment is Capital One. Mm-hmm. So if you have a look at the experience to apply for a Capital One 360 account, it's bordering on effortless. And we've always kind of used Commonwealth Bank as like the benchmark in Australia. And I often joke to people, and it's not a lie, that the Combank experience for applying for a checking account is so easy that I actually got an account with them by accident. I was trying to demo it to another bank executive, and I thought there was going to be another screen. And the next screen said, congratulations, your account's open. Here's your account number. And I got an email saying, here's your account number. You just need to fund your account. I was like, I didn't want an account. I was just trying to show somebody how easy the experience was. But it was so easy that I kind of fell into it by accident.
Well, that reminds me of a conversation I had with Pete Harris at Bain Capital about a year ago, where he said, you know, something shouldn't be so easy. Like, I shouldn't be able to butt dial myself a mortgage. You know, like, you want to have a little bit of a friction.
It needs to be positive friction, though.
Yeah.
Right? So this is the thing, is a signature is just useless friction. Because, you know, let's think about it. It's not secure. It's not unique. It's not, you can't ever secure a physical signature. It's easily copied, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the requirement to physically sign a piece of paper doesn't make sense as friction slowing it down. You can have some friction that says, you're about to put your house on the line. Would you like to proceed? Yes or no? Are you really sure? You know, but you don't need a signature in a paper, on a piece of paper in a branch, right? Mm. So.
And there's things like identity verification. So in order to complete the Combank application, I had to put in my real name, date of birth, and address, because all that was used to verify my identity. So I can't get it by accident. I actually have to provide information. But just one of those anticipated steps of friction, just purely because of my experience of seeing a lot of banks do this, wasn't there, which was actually a pleasant surprise that they made it as easy as they could. But then I never funded the account, so it disappeared.
Absolutely. Well, we got to go to a break, Derek, but really appreciate, where can people find out more information about the report and get a copy of it?
So, yeah, if they want to get a copy, just go to avoka.com. So that's avoka.com. And right on the homepage, there's a link to go and register to download a copy of the report.
Great. Fantastic. And if you are listening to the show, don't forget that we launched recently with Sam Moore, our FinTech 5 podcast. So be sure to check out some of the great interviews he's had in the last couple of weeks, including yours truly, if you want to know a bit more about the writing process and stuff, and which science fiction authors I like to read. So you're listening to Breaking Banks. We have a quick break, and we'll be right back after the break with another guest.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN. What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air.
Gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
You are back with Breaking Banks. We are live from New York City. And we have with us New York. We have with us in the studio Penny Crossman. Hi, Penny.
Hello.
And Mark Hochstein.
Great to be here.
We are right in the depths, the bowels of American Bankers Source Media's offices.
I don't know if bowels is the right bowels. Word. The heights.
The heights. We are on the 26th floor. So, yeah. Thank you for letting us use your space.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
It's great.
It doesn't have our view of the Hudson River.
No.
We're in the... We call this the Charlie Rose room.
The Charlie Rose room. It works. It works.
I happen to like Charlie Rose personally.
No, it works. We've got some video cameras and some lighting and stuff around us. So, trying to just build a picture for you guys to see. Okay. So, listen. We heard from Avoka, from Derek Corcoran on their digital sales and banking report. But right now, we have a new guest. He's the author of a couple of books, Results Rule, and his most recent book, Make Change Work. Randy Peddington, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Oh, thank you, Brett. It's a pleasure.
Now, you also are the creator for integrity-driven leadership and positive performance management. What does that mean?
Well, those are two processes. Integrity-driven leadership really is it's a leadership development process that focuses on how leaders build trust. Positive performance management is truly an integrated system. It's not a technology-based system. It will work with any technology. But it operates on the premise that people are your most valued partners, and if you treat them that way, they will respond that way. Unfortunately, most businesses don't treat their employees as valued partners at all.
Now, it's interesting when we start talking about the challenges that are happening in the financial services space right now. I mean, it's all about change. So if you were going into a big bank in the U.S. right now, where would you start?
Well, obviously, you'd want to start at the top if you're talking about transformational changes. As I was listening to Derek, you and Derek conversation, which I really enjoyed, I was struck by there's two levels of change. There's the big level of change, the transformational changes like Alipay and Bitcoin and what have you. That's a strategic decision at the top. So if I'm talking in the top of the organization, we'd focus there. But you know, at the lower levels of an organization, the changes that really frustrate you are what I consider little changes. How do I deal with the passport issues of going into the UK once Brexit is finalized? That's a little change, but it has a big impact on your ability to get work done. So I think it would depend on sort of what level of the organization and what the purpose of the change was.
Well, say you had a bank that was emphasizing sales over all else and enforcing big sales quotas on their employees.
That's never happened before, has it?
who are you talking about?
What kind of steps might you take in such a situation?
Well, in that situation, I would go back and look at change in expectations. I would focus on three areas. One is change in expectations. And the second is change in rewards. And third is change in accountability. which includes a follow-up process and how you monitor that to make sure that there's some compliance with what you want to have happen. You know, organizations that say that sales at all costs typically end up getting sales that cost them a lot more than they anticipated. So, you know, if I were working in that environment, I would focus there. Then I'd probably come back and add one more piece, and that's what's the behavioral change that has to take place from an education standpoint. There's something going on there where someone is not hearing the right message. And I'm not sure if it was a skill set issue or a systemic issue, but it's one of those two. And so to cover my bases, I would probably add the skill set too.
You know, one of the things we see happening on a global basis, we talked about some of the Chinese payments companies, which are becoming these massive financial services companies. But you have a very different culture for a technology company. And even though we talk about fintechs, most of those are technology first and banking and finance second. Whereas banks tend to be finance and regulation, process and product and channel first. Technology is an enabler of those things. So how, you know, in this environment where we're really looking for banks to enable themselves with technologies, it requires them to work together with organizations that think very different. So we see a lot of fintech and banking partnerships coming along now. We see banks required to submit to an Apple App Store process or Amazon Echo App Store process just to get their app out to customers. So how do you work with two organizations that have those very different cultures? How do you bring them together, Randy? You know, what's the advice about, you know, getting two organizations like that to gel?
Well, first off, the really important word that you used, Brett, was partnerships. And like any partnership, it requires movement and give and take on both sides. So I think that would be the first message for the bank. Realize that if you're a bank, in that environment, you're going to have to be more nimble. And one of the big things I would encourage a bank to look at is define your level of risk tolerance and make sure that that is communicated and consistent through the organization. Because in a technology organization, there's going to be a great deal of risk. It's fail fast, fail often, move on. And in I worked with a bank about 2 weeks ago, one of the large U.S. banks, and it was interesting. Everyone said, yeah, the message we get from our boss is you're empowered to go as fast as you can, but whatever you do, don't screw up.
Yeah.
And so there's a defined risk tolerance that goes along with that. And in case you're wondering which bank that was, it could have been any of them, I think. Then I think that on the bank side, you have to bring the regulators with you. I mean, regulation always lags technology change. And so you have to bring that. And then you have to immerse yourself. You have to become a student of that business and understand how that business drives your customer acquisition, for example. I was very interested when your last guest said most banks don't have small business apps.
Okay, well, so tell me about these seven competencies that you talk about. Organizations must master seven competencies in order to flourish for the future. So what are those competencies and how does that affect culture?
Well, one of those competencies is you have to acknowledge the truth. And that actually is a very important one because nothing ever changes until you do. The second competency that you have to do is actually learn how to develop partnerships, which is that give and take. Third competency, how to focus your energy. So understanding which of those things are truly important. The fourth competency is surrounding accountability. And how do you ensure that there's the accountability that drives where you want to go? The fifth competency is really to focus on building the culture as opposed to just, which is creating the habits within the organization, as opposed to just assuming that something is going to happen. And then I think we're up to like number six, and that is, how do you create an organization that can change and grow every day? So what is that enabler? And then the last one is, how do you do that with a sense of urgency? Lots of people change, but they change at their pace. And really what we need them to do is change at the organization's pace.
So, you know, you talk about culture and the need to accelerate change and, you know, have organizations that can respond faster to change. Because change is happening faster when it comes to technology. So how does an organization start to make that part of their DNA?
First off, they have to be aware of what's going on. Many organizations aren't. And then the second thing is, however fast, and this becomes a leadership challenge, however fast you believe you're going, you need to push the organization to go faster. If you say, how long will it take to get this done? When someone gives you an answer to that, they basically know what's going to happen at that point. They know how to get it done. And so the urgency comes when you push them beyond what they automatically know. And then the other part is how much you pay attention to it. You can't underestimate the impact of a leader paying attention to the urgency or the result that they want to have happen.
I think what often happens in larger financial institutions is that there's so many levels of management, and if you want to get something pushed through and actually get a budget for it and actually, you know, make it happen, you have to get, you know, 20 different levels of approval. And I don't think that's just banks. I think that's almost any large organization with different departments, different groups with stakes and legacy ways of doing things. Do you have any like strategies for kind of building a fast track or, you know, what do you think is needed to really push something, a new partnership or project straight through quickly, like you were just talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question, Penny. One of my clients actually did something very unique, is they created something called a scout team. And it was centered in the old West, Western movies and TV shows. The scouts were the people who went out and rode out on the wagon train and found the next water, if you will. And so this one organization created a team, a cross-functional team within the organization who reported directly to the CEO. And a designated part of their time was to be the scout team, which means they were the people who were looking at the organization and where it needed to be in the future, and then bringing that back directly to the CEO. So we got rid of those, in this case, five or six layers of management, still just as problematic. But by doing that, then their job wasn't to implement. Their job was to bring the idea back, get the solution sold. That way, the CEO could say, this is what we want to do. It sped up the process immensely. In doing it that way, we just went around the levels.
Yeah,
Randy.
Yes, Mark.
There's a trend within the banks the last couple of years of creating the what they call innovation labs or a sandbox, and it'll be like a separate area, like both physically and organizationally, where they'll hire software developers, young people in T-shirts putting up little
cool offices,
sticky notes on the walls.
They have a coffee machine.
And it looks like a startup.
It tries to look like a startup.
Yes. I can tell Brett's a little bit more skeptical. He's a little bit more cynical than I am. But is that a healthy way, or is that boxing off segregation?
Yeah, is that avoiding the real issue, or is it a way to sort of kickstart culture change?
I believe, first off, just because you look like a startup doesn't mean you act like a startup. And I think the idea of creating an innovation lab that operates on its own, pr- probably doesn't change the culture much. Now, if you told me that there was an innovation lab and that people from the business cycle through that as well or could engage in that on a project that they brought that they had an interest in, and they could interact with that group of developers, that would tell me that there's an innovation lab that's tied directly back to the business.
I think that does happen in some cases.
Yeah, we saw we heard from Barclays recently. They've got some Matthew Hooper is their head of innovation, and he kind of pairs the business people up, brings them into the innovation lab, has them talk to startups that they bring in.
I heard of an innovation lab that a foreign bank has here in New York. Have you heard of this story? They don't have anyone working in the innovation lab, but they bring...
It's true innovation. It's all AI. Mm-hmm.
No. And they bring people in and put them in the innovation lab for a few days to get them to feel what innovation is like. I won't say who
it's
it
an
is.
Immersion.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's become cool to have, especially to have an innovation lab in New York.
True.
Deutsche, Barclays.
You know, I spoke with the CIO of USAA a little over a year or so ago, and you know they allow people to bring innovation ideas. I mean, you bring the idea, then you get the time in the lab. So, I mean, it's not you're assigned to the lab, now go be innovative. But they encourage people to be innovative, and then you go to the lab. So they start with that. And one of the things that intrigued me, he said the guy who had the most innovations actually implemented was the part-time employee who worked at the security gate driving into the facility over the weekends.
That's very cool.
Wow.
Because he sat there in his guard shack the entire weekend long with not much going on except him and his laptop. And he was truly engaged in helping the company succeed.
Yeah, they should probably hire him as the head of innovation. Give him an upgrade. Give him
innovation and security.
Yeah.
Right.
So, so Randy, one question that sort of is always on the back of our mind at the moment, you talk about in your book, you talked about the rate of change, you know, specifically, you said a world of constant change. You know, that's how you characterized it. Now, we're about to go into some pretty significant changes around things like artificial intelligence and automation. And yet you have these political movements right now here in the US and in the UK where there's real pushback against change. So what's going to happen to these two worlds? Are they going to collide?
They absolutely will collide, and the change will win because ultimately the change doesn't care that those two movements are pushing back.
Right.
And so there's always resistance. If there's no resistance, there's no change.
Right.
So, I mean, I look at that and go, that's normal. Now, what that's setting up, the level of resistance, it's setting up for a catastrophic movement going forward. And at some point, the technology is just going to take over. I mean, when I wrote Make Change Work, I sort of visioned out as far as I could do. And I assumed that my UPS deliveries would be a robot in the back of a self-driving vehicle.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and now nobody thinks about that because Amazon's going to float.
Yeah, you're going to have drones and
floating fulfillment centers. Yeah. So, I think the biggest challenge for organizations, the biggest challenge for our society, is not that things are going to change. It's how do we protect the things that are important as we change.
Yeah,
you know, on that note. Randy, there's a saying that I think about when people talk about disruption, and I'm going to sound a little bit like an old fogey here, but you know they say don't tear down a fence if you don't know why it was built. And do you ever see in the companies you work with sometimes changes that were made too hastily, that that some procedure or what appeared to be useless red tape actually served some purpose?
Oh, absolutely. Most of the good ideas, I mean, I go back to this. Everything that frustrates you in an organization today was at one point someone's brilliant idea to solve an immediate problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And so before you tear down that fence, let's make sure we understand what the problem is that we were solving at the time. And then there's also the other side of that, Mark, and that's the biggest fear a lot of employees have in organizations is when their boss goes away to a conference and comes back with a book. because there's a pretty good sign that there's going to be a new change. And so it can't be just change. I mean, we use the term MBBS, management by bestseller. It can't be just the bestseller. You have to solve a legitimate problem.
BS for something else.
That's a family show here.
Yeah. So, Randy, let me ask you this. You said you're working on a couple of new ideas, a couple of new books. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the books is called, the short was AFBOC, Another Fine Book on Change. And it's, fine will be, because it's a family show. And the AFBOC book is the book that we have a lot of our CEO clients that say, I wish I could tell my employees what I really want them to know about change. Can you tell them? And I think it's a little sad that CEOs won't tell their employees exactly what they need to know. But this is a book designed for employees that basically says, here's what's coming and here's how you get ready for it. And the second idea that I'm working on is one that I think has some application in your world. And that is the challenge of the future is not just executing today. It's keeping one foot firmly planted on execution today with the other foot firmly planted on what's happening in the future. And that is that's a difficult balance to face in most organizations.
Well, we just a quick shout out to Dave Birch and thanking him for posting his signature online for all to see. Although his signature appears to be suggesting that his name is Sergio Agnes, not Dave Birch. So, and also, shout out to him. Dave says that ultimately RegTech is more important to banks than fintech because it's going to be the biggest change. That's
powerful.
IBM would like to hear that.
Yeah. And it's bang on, I think.
Well, it's the biggest problem the financial.
Everyone says they keep the reason they can't change is all this regulation. Mm-hmm. So you change the way regulation works, it's going to change the way banks work. So
it could. So
everyone assumes that bankers don't want to make more money, don't want to have more customers, and it's not the bankers that's the problem; it's the regulator.
Yeah. So, do you think we need more regulation or less regulation, or we just need to change the way regulation works?
I think we need. I don't know that we need more. I think we need less right now. We need to focus on the regulations that are. That work in the world today, not in the that work in the world that used to be.
Yeah.
And so I think we need a different kind of regulation.
So tell me about, artificial intelligence and the fact that if you introduce AI into an organization like a bank or an accounting firm or an investment firm, where suddenly all of this data analysis was done by humans over Excel spreadsheets over thousands of hours is replaced by an algorithm. How would you go, if you were an organization getting ready for that change and they invited you in, how would you advise them in terms of retraining their staff, looking at new skills? Where would you start with a plan to future-proof the organization?
Well, the first thing I would start with is that most of the jobs that are there as they are going to be gone. So if you're happy with the level of your business right now, get ready. You'll do that business with far fewer employees. But I think the missing opportunity, and this is where I try to get people to focus all the time, it's what new opportunity does having all of this work go away from? What things can you do to distinguish yourself in the marketplace? And so I want to think about what are those customer relationship areas? What are those experience management areas that we can do that are uniquely human from a creativity and a relationship building standpoint? How do we focus on those and how do we retrain people to go there? Because the analysis jobs that those will go away.
Yeah.
The question always is, with new technology, do you use it to downsize what you have or do you use it to optimize and allow your organization to go into new areas? Mm-hmm. And any time that happens, there's going to be winners and losers in that process.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like the entry-level worker is going to be disproportionately affected because, you know, there's going to be a lot of the grunt work or less process-related work is going to be automated, and then there'll be new sort of tech jobs created to design the software, program the software, monitor the software, supervise bots and things like that. But will there be any way of generating new jobs for the person who's not a techie, you know, and is just come out of college, needs that entry level job?
It will be difficult to do in financial services, unless we're talking about a client relationship person who has an individual contact. Now, there will be other jobs. I mean, there's going to be some jobs that will be uniquely human for the foreseeable future, but they may not be in the banking finance industry. They may be in healthcare, for example.
Yeah. Well, that's great, Randy. I appreciate you being on the show today and giving us your insights. Where can people find more about Randy Pennington and about the work you're doing?
Well, the easy place is on our website at Pennington Group, all one word, PenningtonGroup.com.
It's double N.
That's right.
And you can check out Randy's book, Make Change Work, on Amazon. It's available right there. So, yeah, thanks for joining us. And
My pleasure.
Very, very interesting. And Mark and Penny, what do you guys got planned for the rest of the week?
Oh, the week is almost over, isn't it?
Yeah, tomorrow is the Neal Awards here in New York. Mm-hmm. American Banker is a finalist in several categories. Well, and our Washington Bureau Chief is going to receive a special award, the Timothy White Award for Excellence in Editorial Leadership.
Wow.
So congratulations, Rob.
Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations.
Well done.
Rob Blackwell.
Well, thank you guys for both joining us today. Just so I do my duty here, don't forget, please go to iTunes, leave us a review. Check out Google Play, SoundCloud, iTunes. You can go, all those places, or breakingbanks.com. You can get more information about our back episodes and so forth. And don't forget to check out FinTech 5 with Sam Moore. And we've got coming up 3 or 4 new podcasts that should be released shortly. So you'll hear more about that soon. Have a great week, guys. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you back at Breaking Banks next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.